The Lincoln Highway stretched from New York City to San Francisco, the first true transcontinental highway. But the network of roads called the Lincoln Highway in 1913 didn't look much like what we think of as a highway today. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we celebrate the centennial of the Lincoln Highway. When it was designated in 1913, it was the beginning of a movement that would transform the United States. Today, we'll talk about the history of the Father Road, from the first paved mile to the miles and miles of gumbo mud that Iowa became famous for. And I'll get a taste of what it was like to ride the highway in a 1924 Model T Ford. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This summer, people all over the United States are celebrating the centennial of the Lincoln Highway. In fact, people from all over the world are celebrating the centennial of the Lincoln Highway. Just yesterday and today, more than 70 cars with drivers from Norway, Germany, Denmark, and Sweden are traveling the Lincoln Highway through Iowa. And this hour, we're going to talk about the history and the significance of the Father Road. We also want to hear your memories. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, and you can call 866-780-9100. We'll also get a little taste of what it was like to travel the highway in a 1924 Model T Ford. The Lincoln Highway was designated in 1913. The route stretched across the country from New York City to San Francisco and across Iowa from Clinton to Council Bluffs. Brian Butko is here with me. He is the author of many books about the Lincoln Highway, including Greetings from the Lincoln Highway, a road trip celebration of America's first coast-to-coast highway, now out in a centennial edition. Hello, Brian.
Hello. Glad to be
Brian, are you there?
Yes. Hello. Glad to be talking about the Lincoln Highway.
Apparently, some people can hear Brian, but I cannot. So I will talk to Hank Zalatel first. Hank is retired, but he was the librarian for the Department of Transportation in Iowa for many years. Hello, Hank.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And Hank, we're going to talk about the beginnings, the origins of the Lincoln Highway with Brian here in just a couple of minutes. But when this highway was designated, was there in Iowa, were there negotiations about where this road would go within the state?
There, in fact, were many towns vying to have the road come through their town, because if you had the road, people would stop at your gas station, they would stop at your cafe, they would stay in your hotel, and they would bring economic benefits to your community. And so just like today with economic development, there's all kinds of things, benefits that towns offer to companies to come in. And it was the same way with the Lincoln Highway.
All right. And I should be able to hear Brian now. Apparently my headphones were in the wrong mode. So, Brian, can you hear me?
Hi, I can hear you.
Yes, and I can hear you. That's
great.
Exciting. All right. Brian, before we dig more into Iowa history with Hank, when the highway was designated, you know, today when we build a highway, it's a very different thing from when the Lincoln Highway was designated in 1913.
Sure.
What was this route like in 1913?
Well, the route was certainly far more rural than it is even today. And we tend to think of the good old days of motoring with motor camps and gas stations and diners. And that all came along, but that's not until the 1920s. 1913, you're talking pretty much wagon ruts across most of the country.
And not just wagon ruts, but when you describe in your book, you describe people traveling out west, this pathway was going across ranches. There were fences across where the road was supposed to be.
Yeah, they were just heading west, and those were their instructions to close the ranch gate behind them. And when they get to the next one, miles and miles later, to open it up and do the same. It was a pretty daunting experience, and it was really seen as one of the last great adventures. People had been to Europe or around the Cape of South America, and now the American West beckoned as the big new adventure.
What made this road different? Since it's not like they built a highway, what made this route that was designated different from other routes that had been talked about in the past?
Well, most of all, there really weren't roads across the country, let alone between cities. Coast-to-coast routes had been proposed since the late 1800s, especially by bicyclists, who were far more common than people owning automobiles. But the Lincoln Highway was the first one to really have the power behind it to mark the route and improve the route and promote the route. And people could become members of the Lincoln Highway Association. You would send in your $5 and get back a great little packet of stuff, and you could order pennants for a couple dollars to hang from your car. And so it was different because it was promoted. It was, for better or worse, a red line on the map, which could be a disadvantage, jokingly, that it wasn't improved. But on the other hand, as Hank had said, it put your town on the map that you wanted to be on that line.
With this designation and this road, what was driving it? What gave it more power?
It was the idea of people in the automobile industry, primarily Carl Fisher, who had risen to fame for creating the Indianapolis Speedway and paving it with brick. And he was quite the huckster of his era, but knew how to get things done, knew the people who would get things done. So along with Henry Joy, the president of Packard, and Frank Seiberling of Goodyear, everyone except Henry Ford was in there helping to fund the road and support it. And that's what made it unique. It was in an era before the government was into road building. Believe it or not, the government didn't want its hand in road building. So it was a private idea funded by men in the automobile industry and people like me and you.
And this road really was anything but straight. How did people find their way along the Lincoln Highway?
Right. Well, of course, their wish was to make it straight. And if they could be here 100 years later, I-80 would probably be the ultimate descendant of their wishes. But as you said, it wasn't straight. It was a cobbling together of other roads, old turnpikes in the east and wagon roads and the emigrant trails out west. And so at first the marking was pretty informal by painting the colors on telephone poles or later on putting up signs that would direct people. But as you can imagine, paint and even signs wouldn't last more than a year or two.
Right. I'm sure a lot of people got lost.
Sure.
And how long, in 1913, how long did it take to cross the country in a car?
Well, it would take at least a couple weeks, if not more. And it became quite common for wealthy Easterners to head west and take about a month. And when they arrived in California, to send their car back on the automobile. But it was such an adventure that a great many of them wrote memoirs about it. And today we have a rich collection of books that remain from that era of people, even like Emily Post, who would, before her rise to fame, who would write a book about what it was like to travel west on the Lincoln Highway.
We're talking about the centennial of the Lincoln Highway and the early history of the Lincoln Highway today. Brian Butko is my guest. He's author of many books about the Lincoln Highway, including Greetings from the Lincoln Highway, A Road Trip Celebration of America's First Coast-to-Coast Highway. Hank Zalatel is also with me. He was the librarian for the Department of Transportation in Iowa for many years. And we want to hear from you, your memories of the Lincoln Highway at 866-780-9100. With me now is Bob Owens, who grew up on the Lincoln Highway. He's from Jefferson. And Bob, I know you don't have a lot of time, so I want to get a little bit of your memories right now. So when you were a boy, How close were you to the Lincoln Highway?
Well, Charity, I was born in 1927, and I grew up a block off of the Lincoln Highway here in Jefferson. And, of course, during the Depression, that was the excitement to sit over and watch the traffic on the highway. And, by the way, I'm a Lincoln Highway member, charter member of the 43 that restarted this whole association in October 1992.
Terrific.
So I've been a Lincoln Highway fan all my life, and I own a Lincoln Highway marker and have it in my front yard.
So,
but I grew up watching the traffic on the highway, and...
Bob, when you were a kid and you were watching that traffic on the highway, what did it mean to you to see all these license plates from faraway places in Jefferson, Iowa?
Oh, boy, you know, we was a kid during the Depression. We hadn't been any place. So to see all these, here come a California car, and if they had sunglasses, well, they were automatically movie stars.
Well, and some of them probably were.
Yeah, yeah. And we got 100 stories, of course, of the highway, and... one of her good stories was a man named Doug Wessling. He was a kid living over east of Grand Junction. He was telling about when he was a little boy, all the weekend his dad spent hauling people out of the mud hole on the Lincoln Highway.
And so I think a lot of Iowans spent a lot of time doing that.
We said, Doug, well, what were you doing during the week? Hauling water to that mud hole. So, yeah.
So, Bob, as one of the charter members of this re-energized Lincoln Highway Association, Brian just mentioned the early Lincoln Highway Association that people could join when the highway was founded. Mm-hmm. Again, that association was reformed in 1992 as a way to preserve the highway.
Oh, correct.
Why is it important to you to preserve this history, Bob?
Well, it's a transportation history. It's the first transcontinental highway across the United States. And here, of course, in Jefferson, we're on the first transcontinental railroad, too, the old Chicago Northwestern, which is now the Union Pacific. And so we sit right here, and we have our little Greene County Lincoln Highway Museum is over in Grand Junction, sitting right between the railroad and the highway. And we have lots of memorabilia in there.
And why do you think it's important for people who don't have memories of the Lincoln Highway to learn about it?
Well, it's history. History of transportation is what it is. And those that are interested, and we've drawn a fine group of people in this organization, and which we just had a fine tour again. And it's important, as all history is, and this is strictly a transportation.
All right. Well, Bob, I need to let you go. I know you need to move on your way. Bob Owens grew up on the Lincoln Highway. He is from Jefferson and one of the charter members of the reformed Lincoln Highway Association. I'll get back to my conversation with Brian Butko and Hank Zalatel in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa.
My pappy said, son, you're going to drive me to drinking if you don't stop driving that hot rod Lincoln. Have you heard the story of the hot rod race with the Fords and Lincolns was setting the pace? That story is true, I'm here to say, I was driving that Model A. It's got a Lincoln motor and it's really souped up. That Model A body makes it look like a pup's got 8 cylinders and uses them all. Got overdrive, just won't stall.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are celebrating the centennial of the Lincoln Highway, the first transcontinental highway in the United States. And it ran from New York City to San Francisco. It was designated in 1913. And of course, it went right across Iowa as well, called the Father Road by many. Brian Butko is here. He's the author of many books about the Lincoln Highway, including Greetings from the Lincoln Highway, a road trip celebration of America's first coast-to-coast highway, which is now out in a new centennial edition. Hank Zalatel is here. He is retired now, but he was the librarian for the Department of Transportation in Iowa for many years. And again, we talk about that term highway. When we refer to the Lincoln Highway, we've talked about how it was a connection of many other roads and trails in many places. How long, Brian, did it take for the Lincoln Highway to be paved?
Well, what would happen is that at a local level, of course, towns wanted the traffic to go through their town at first, but then pretty soon they found there's also a disadvantage to that, that you have every single tourist, traveler, and cross-country trucker going through your town. So little bypasses started to be built maybe just a block or two north and eventually around the whole town until the federal highways, Route 30, and then Interstate became the ultimate bypass. So some of the original Lincoln Highway is still out there, and it's not paved. But it took until the 1930s before you could really travel across Iowa or the entire country on hard surface pavement.
Well, and Hank, when they were building the road, when they were designating the road and trying to create something that was really drivable, there was a movement to create seedling miles, right?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Seedling mile was their brainstorm to create 1 mile of concrete in an area that was mire. They used to call the road in Iowa gumbo. And there would be gumbo on either side of this mile, and you would come to this beautiful surface where you could drive at a relatively high speed for 1 mile, and then you would fall off the cliff and go into the mud again. And for people traveling through Iowa during this time, sometimes it would take a half a day to go 30 miles. And it was one of the things that really got people to start advocating for good roads was a football game at the University of Iowa in the late 20s, where during the day it was fine for everyone going on the road to Iowa City. But in the afternoon, it started to rain, and everyone got stranded on the way home. And so the people realized the need for good roads.
And how many seedling miles were there in
Iowa? There was only one.
Just one.
And it was outside of Cedar Rapids by Mount Vernon. And it was replaced just recently, and a beautiful booklet was produced as mitigation for them defacing the road, actually to make it better so that it was safer.
And Brian, in your book, you share a lot of people's memories of traveling on the Lincoln Highway, but Iowa really was famous for our mud.
Yeah, I think my favorite quote, one of the people who wrote their book said that in one day they made more distance left to right than they did forward.
Because they were sliding back and forth.
Yep.
Okay. And a lot of people got trapped. A lot of farmers helped them out. And you had excerpts from people's memoirs who write about that as well, saying that they couldn't even pay people for helping them out of the mud. No one would take payment.
Yeah. Farmers had a mixed reaction to roads like the Lincoln Highway, that they didn't really want city people coming through, and they didn't want to pay for a road that would just bring more traffic and kill more of their chickens and livestock. But at the same time, they're friendly people. They want to help, and some of them did make a living charging to pull people out of mud holes. So as Hank said, it really wasn't until that football game that more than anything showed that thousands of people could really benefit by improved roads, which already by then it had been a good 15 years that the rest of the country had latched on to this idea of better roads.
Right. And there were problems that the drivers caused. You mentioned the chickens. A lot of chickens paid for the Lincoln Highway with their lives, didn't they?
Yeah, some of the memoir writers say that they felt really bad at how many dozens they would kill across each state.
And the Lincoln Highway in Iowa also, as time went on, became famous not just for its mud, but also for its amazing bridges. Hank, we really have some remarkable bridges along the Lincoln Highway.
Yes. The DOT, in fact, in 1992, established an inventory of all the historic bridges that are now in Iowa that are still standing, and that's available on their website. Also, That was one of the main reasons why the Highway Commission was formed in 1913, was to ensure that there was a standardization for bridge models. Before, cities and counties would go out and they would have to pay a company to use their patent to build a bridge. And with the Highway Commission being established, they made standardized plans that everyone could use without charge. And there's a famous bridge in Tama right now that has the Lincoln Highway in the bridge rail. And it's one of their biggest tourist attractions.
Right, and it's actually block letters, cement block letters, yes, that says the Lincoln, or it just says Lincoln Highway along each side, right?
Yes, and they actually have a festival to celebrate. There's also the town of Nevada has Lincoln Highway Days. And so they are building on the Lincoln Highway as a means to expand their community.
And there's also the famous Rainbow Bridge that is near where Bob lives, but it's west of Ogden, right?
Right. There was also another publication published by the DOT on the Rainbow Arch bridges, because while the bridges are beautiful, they're functionally deficient now. Big farm equipment cannot cross these bridges, and so they either have to be replaced or bypassed, or they have to be torn down. And there are several in Boone County right now.
All right, we're going to take a short break right now, and we're going to go for a ride. But before we do that, I'll mention I'm talking with Hank Zalatel. He is retired, but he was a librarian for the Department of Transportation in Iowa for many years. Stay with us, Hank. Brian Butko is also here, the author of many books about the Lincoln Highway, and we want to hear from you. Call us with your memories and your stories about the Lincoln Highway, 866-780-9100, or send your memories to Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. And now let's go for a ride. Dean Yoder lives outside of Iowa City, and he is a member of the Model T Ford Club of America and Model T International. And he has a 1924 Model T Ford that he has driven all over North America. Dean, why did you decide that you were going to get a Model T?
My Uncle Ted gave me a ride in his, which is exactly like this, when I was 5 years old, and I was hooked. Ever since then, I wanted one of my own.
And you got this car in 1997. How did you get your hands on it?
Actually, I found it on the internet in Sedalia, Missouri. I talked to my son about it, and we decided we needed it.
You needed it.
Yeah, we needed it. Well, we had a closed car, but we didn't have an open car. And open cars just seemed to be more fun.
So you did this in kind of a rush job, because you got it around Valentine's Day, and then your son decided he wanted to take it to his prom?
His senior prom, and it was like 3 weeks from the time that he set it for the prom. And I told him that there was no way we could do it unless we stole the motor out of our Model T ton truck. And he said, let's go. That's at 11 o'clock at night that we started tearing the motor out of the ton truck.
So you've been actually driving the car all over the United States. How many miles have you put, and not just the United States, Canada too, right?
Yes.
How many miles have you put on this car?
Well, I have over 88,000 miles. I've traveled to 49 states, 6 Canadian provinces, 2 Canadian territories, and across the Arctic Circle in Canada and Alaska. So I have more fun than the average person with their Model T.
Okay, so take us back in time. This car was built in 1924. So in 1924, the Lincoln Highway was 11 years old. And there were still stretches of the Lincoln Highway that were pretty rough during that time. When you go out on the road, and I know you've driven a lot of gravel roads in this car, when you go out on the road, what kind of challenges do you have?
Well, most of the challenges are when you get into the off-country driving. The back roads, the minimum maintenance roads, the fun roads. The longest gravel road that we have driven with it was the Dempster Highway, which travels almost 500 miles through the wilderness to Inuvik Northwest Territory. And this is a road that I've got to go back and drive on again.
Now, you just got back from Kearney, Nebraska, where the big Lincoln Highway Centennial Celebration was, and you drove the car there?
Yeah, I drove the car there on the 29th of June. I left home at about 7:30, and I had some trouble with my trailer, so I had to come back home and replace the wheel bearing in it. And then I drove on to Minden, Nebraska, where I camped for the first night, and that was 466 miles. And by the GPS, I was traveling 37.2 miles an hour, moving average. I think my maximum speed was 56.1, and my traveling time was a little over 12 hours, and my gassing up and potty break time was about 2 hours.
Now, a lot of the Lincoln Highway is on pretty busy roads now. Did you actually drive there on the Lincoln Highway?
Actually, I went on southern route on Highway 2 in Iowa, but when I came home, I left Kearney, and I traveled on the Lincoln Highway until I got to Iowa, which is, not excessively busy, but a little more truck traffic than I like to have.
You're driving in one of the cars that really transformed the United States. And we're talking about one of the roads that really transformed the United States. You have a better idea of what that experience of driving on that road at that time would have been like than most of us. What should we know about that?
Well, we can't imagine what it was like back then. The roads, you know, some places they were you go to this tree and then you turn at that tree, and the maps were non-existent. Now I travel with a GPS with the car. So when Reg and I went to Alaska with it, we both commented that, boy, this is a real experience, but it can't be anything like driving in the 20s was with it.
What do you love about driving this car?
Well, I get to see more while I'm traveling. I don't see as much when I'm there because I spend all my time traveling. And I meet so many wonderful people from all over the world because I'm a real odd-looking vehicle going down the road because I'm traveling with a wagon. Two-wheeled vintage wagon behind me, and the wagon's rarer than the car.
How do you deal with the noise?
Well, I'm a little hard of hearing, so that part helps. The worst noise for me can be a heavy side wind blowing in your ear.
And the car doesn't look very warm. Do you take it out when it's chilly?
Oh, yes. Actually, there's a lot of heat that comes up through the floorboard. The window can be tilted back in, and that allows it to catch air and shoot it down and cool your feet. And then there's a rain flap on the top of the windshield. If you unhook it and let it blow in, you get a breeze across your forehead, so that helps a lot.
Well, can you show me how to start the car?
There's two ways. It is 24, so it does have electric start. But it also has the crank. I have to make sure this lever is up. That's my spark advance. And if you don't have that up, it can kick back and break your arm was the common thing.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, my.
I've never had it break my arm, but I have had it kick back.
All right, and here's the crank.
Now, you'll want to stand back a little
bit. You're just throttling it back there?
Yeah, I advanced the spark, and then I closed the gas so it wouldn't rev up too fast. And that is the original horn. It wasn't an Ooga horn on a Model T. It was a vibrator horn.
Oh, awesome. Will you take me for a little ride?
Sure.
Okay.
Now, the Model T is a little different than a modern car. You see, I've got three pedals on the floor, and I also have a little lever in the middle.
Okay, what do the pedals do?
The lever on the side is my parking brake.
Okay.
The left pedal is a clutch pedal. It puts it in low, or if this is forward, when you let it clear out, it put it in high. The center pedal is reverse. And the right pedal would be your brakes.
So how often do you have to stop to let things cool down or to adjust something?
Basically, whenever I gas up, I should check my oil. Model doesn't use that much oil, but
they have a tendency to mark their spot by leaking.
What kind of mileage do you get?
Depending on what I'm pulling, 12 to 20 miles per gallon.
And how big a tank do you have?
The tank is about an 8-gallon tank. And we're sitting on it, right underneath the front seat in this car.
Well, that seems like a safety feature, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I went for a ride with Dean Yoder. He lives outside of Iowa City and drives a 1924 Model T Ford. He took me out on a minimum maintenance road and also, just for good measure, drove through the ditch. He said those cars can go absolutely anywhere. This hour, we are talking about the Lincoln Highway, celebrating the centennial, talking about the history of the Lincoln Highway, its significance for the nation, its significance in the state of Iowa. We'll get back to that conversation in a moment, and we want to hear your memories. Join us with your memories at 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa.
Jones and a pretty little queen took a ride one day in his big limousine. The car kicked up and the engine wouldn't crank. There wasn't any gas in the gasoline tank. Just about that time along came Nord, and he rambled right along in his little old Ford. He stole that queen as his engine sang a song, and his little old Ford just rambled right along. His little old Ford rambled right along, and the little old Ford rambled right along. The gas ran out in the big machine, but the darned little Ford don't need gasoline. The big limousine had to back downhill, but the
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the Lincoln Highway, which was first designated in 1913. This is the centennial year for the Lincoln Highway. With me is Brian Butko. He is the author of a number of books about the Lincoln Highway, including Greetings from the Lincoln Highway, A Road Trip Celebration of America's First Coast-to-Coast Highway, out in a new edition now to celebrate the centennial. Hank Zalatel is here. He was the librarian for the Department of Transportation in Iowa for many years. And Brian, we got an email from Jackie. She says there's a large book of photographs of the Lincoln Highway of the late 1970s by Iowa graduate Drake Hokanson. This is a part of the history because many of the landmarks are still standing. That book came out in 1999. It is a beautiful book, and that was a big influence on you, right?
It was, and in fact, I just published another book for the centennial for the Lincoln Highway Association called The Lincoln Highway Photos Through Time, and in it, I dedicate my foreword to Drake Hokanson. He really is responsible for the revival of interest in the Lincoln Highway. His book actually came out in the late 1980s and paperback in the 90s. And it really did affect a few of us at the time who thought we were the only ones out there on this road. It was nice to have his book and his reassuring writing telling us that others were out there, and that was one of the steps that led to the reforming of the Lincoln Highway Association in 1992.
All right. I want to bring Dan Otto into the conversation now as well. He's an emeritus professor at Iowa State University in the Department of Economics. Hello, Dan.
Hi, Jody.
Thank you so much for being here today. And I want to talk about the economics of the Lincoln Highway. I know that you've done a great deal of research about the impact that highway bypasses had on communities in Iowa. And, of course, the Lincoln Highway went through a lot of small towns. Do you know what kind of impact that had, the fact that people suddenly were driving through these small towns? I spent the first 5 years of my life in Ogden, Iowa. That was one of those communities where the Lincoln Highway was the main street of Ogden, Iowa. What kind of impact did that have on these little towns, Dan?
Well, the highways served both the local markets and the statewide markets. So these, the Lincoln Highway was a commercial highway connecting across states. So would bring a lot of traffic into town, and a lot of businesses would spring up to serve those two different markets. The cafes, gas stations, lodging was the traveling public, and then the Main Street merchants would serve the local markets, trade areas, along with, folks who would stop in as well. So, and over time, Brian mentioned the heavy all the truck traffic that came in. You'd have conflict between these two audiences, and some people wanted to take steps to reduce congestion, noise, to have a more pleasant shopping environment. But if your business was selling gas to customers, you might not like that.
Right. Well, and I'm sure that for the trucks that were traveling through these small towns, there was some frustration with local people as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, they have to slow down and deal with a lot of stop signs. And so that was the motivation for bypassing these local communities. And there are different waves of bypass. Now, the interstate highway system had a wave of bypasses. And I guess in the 70s and 80s, there was another set of bypasses. And the local communities have these various concerns. But what typically happened was these merchants that catered to traveling public would go to where the new interchanges were and set up business there. The overall retail sales wouldn't be affected so much, just that different businesses would spring up. They would be transferred between different audiences or different businesses.
Well, and the way we were building highways, of course, changed a lot from the early days of the Lincoln Highway. So how did that change the Lincoln Highway and Brian, maybe you can weigh in on this as well, and Hank, when we started building these other roads that would cut through areas that were hard to get through and were long and straight and paved. And Hank, why don't you take that first?
For the long-term traveler who was going across the country, they did not want to stop in these small towns. They wanted to get from point A to point B as quickly as possible. And so when they had to go through these small towns, sometimes it would add hours to their trip because of the traffic, the congestion, the trucks blocking the road. And many of the roads in these small towns were only two lane. So you could get stopped and your frustration built.
And in 1956, there was the Federal Aid Highway Act. That had to change things a lot as well.
Yes, it did. The freeways began. The first interchange was in West Des Moines, the Cloverleaf on US 6, and they began the Des Moines Freeway in 1958. And each year, as time progressed, new sections would be built. And as Dan said, the old businesses, the motels, the cafes, they either had to move to the new interchanges, or they would see their business cut in half or 75%.
And so how much, Dan, did these bypasses, we talk about the Lincoln Highway as old 30, and of course, you know, Highway 30 travels across the state of Iowa, and you don't go through a lot of small towns, at least in different stretches of Highway 30. How much did that impact the economics?
It's the larger trade areas, I guess, is part of an overall change in the retailing in the state and the country. The large trade areas, Des Moines, draw people in. So it's good highways lead into that. It's just an example is, you know, Marshalltown is a community that's going on its third or fourth bypass of the 30. The original bypasses didn't have a lot of as many restrictions on access, and so pretty soon you had the same congestion problems and have to move out with another bypass. So, but the original Highway 30 would be relieved of some of the traffic and could take on some of its former character, and I think that's what we're seeing in stretches of the highway.
Well, right, and I think about Ogden because, of course, as I mentioned, I spent the first 5 years of my life there and then visited family there for many, many years after that. And in my memory, the main street of Ogden was pretty sleepy, and it got a lot sleepier as time went on. Now, of course, a lot of that had to do with the farm crisis in the 1980s. But I have to believe that there was a slow process after the bypass was built, where a lot of businesses in a town like Ogden really took a major hit. Dan?
Yes. They were left with their local trade area, and there's fewer and fewer people in that trade area. I guess it is harder and harder to maintain those businesses. So, it's just maybe another sign of the changes in rural areas where And there's just not as many people in some of these places to support the businesses that had been there.
Right.
And,
well,
and the roads let them go travel further to Des Moines for their shopping instead of just shopping in local downtown Ogden.
Right. We have this. We do want to hear your memories. And we have this memory from Jerry in Knoxville. I was born in 1934, living in on the west side of Iowa where my parents were teachers. Or in Westside, Iowa, where my parents were teachers. Mother restrained me with a harness and rope connected to the clothesline. Once at age three, I got loose and wandered a few blocks from home, and I was found on the other side of the Lincoln Highway playing in the gravel. So I'm sure a heart attack moment for Mom and Dad there. We do want to hear your memories at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Brian, as people traveled the Lincoln Highway, there were a lot of new kinds of businesses that were created in Iowa and all across the country, right?
Right, because until then, travelers typically taking the train would stay at hotels in a town, and they had no need for the businesses that we come to associate with that early travel, the gas stations and motels. And so those early travelers were faced with what to do, and often they ended up camping by the side of the road, and that did evolve into organized camps that the towns would own and then later entrepreneurs would. And first you have a cabin, and pretty soon you have a motel going.
And it's amazing to think the kind of discomfort that those early travelers must have traveled in. I mean, not only were the cars open and noisy and got flat tires a lot and got stuck in the mud a lot, but there were advice pamphlets given out about how to camp alongside the road. You quote one that says, you should dig a trench for your hips for more comfort in sleeping on the ground.
Yeah, imagine that was the advice to be comfortable.
Right.
And the same with restaurants. Today we like to dismiss fast food as being generic and homogenous and not capturing local variety. And of course that's true. But there's a reason that grew up, and that's because of the inability to always know where to stop. There weren't many restaurants. If you did, what was the quality? And of course, people knew that down the road, after you left a place, your sick stomach was a reflection of regret from the place you had just stopped and the unsanitary conditions.
Now, in your book, you go state by state across the Lincoln Highway and in great detail about some of the businesses that still remain on the Lincoln Highway in each state and in Iowa. What are some of your favorite places to visit on the Lincoln Highway in Iowa?
Well, Iowa is one of the most popular states because of so many different places to see and stop. I would have to say the most popular one is at Colo, Iowa, and actually it reflects that three generation of the original Lincoln Highway, and then south of there US 30, and then farther south I-80. But there is what is called a one-stop built back in the 20s, where one-stop meaning you could get your gas, food, and lodging all in one place. And when I first saw it more than 20 years ago, it was looking kind of rough around the edges, but it's been restored. The town got behind it, actually. And the gas station is now a museum, but the Colo Motel is once again renting rooms. And the most spectacular part is Nyland's Cafe there, which not only has a mini museum to highway travel, but is a throwback to those kind of cafes with the stools at the counter and the jukebox and good friendly food and service. So more than anything, when you're traveling, a place like Nyland's Cafe at Colo is the kind of place that you look forward to nowadays. And I think will really become one of the premier attractions along the Lincoln Highway, much as some famous stops have sprung up along Route 66, which predates the Lincoln Highway in the modern era of name recognition.
Right. And you mentioned how Drake Hokanson's book really spurred excitement about preserving the Lincoln Highway. Mm-hmm. But, of course, it's grown way beyond that, and a lot of people are very excited about the centennial. Why do you think this touches a chord with so many people?
Well, I think that all that standardization that we really do want and even whether it's a restaurant or the interstate. If you need to travel 500 miles by the end of today, you'll want to choose the interstate. But that is so prevalent in our lives, whether it's our cell phones or our interstates or restaurants, that we look for something with a human touch. And so the Lincoln Highway is being rediscovered as that. It's a nice mixture that it's not as random as just heading out into the country and not knowing where you'll go or what you'll find, but yet it's not as generic or standardized as taking a four-lane freeway with the same chain restaurants at the end. It's that nice mixture that you get an idea where you'll go. And even with my guidebooks, I never want to be comprehensive. I want there to be some mystery and romance left for the people who follow my books. But yet they'll know that at least in some of the cities where they can go, like the Colo Cafe or Youngville Station, another one-stop-turned modern-day rest stop popular for its pies, near Rapid City.
And Hank, do you have a favorite place on the Lincoln Highway in Iowa?
Well, I would like to tell you a story about a wetland that it was right in the middle of the highway, about 2 miles east of Colo, in Colo. And I talked to the old mayor, and he would relate the story of the farmer sitting by this huge wetland and saying, if you pay a dollar now and you get stuck, I will gladly pull you out. But if you refuse to pay the dollar and you decide to go ahead and you do get stuck, then the charge is $3 to pull you out. And I thought that that was the business spirit there taking place along the highway.
So those early days of farmers refusing to take any payment maybe turned into some serious business savvy as time went on.
And in fact, the wetland is still there and the road goes right through it.
Wow. Do you think that, Brian, do you think that we'll be celebrating the sesquicentennial? Do you think that the interest in the Lincoln Highway is going to endure even past the time when people have living memories of driving on it?
Well, that's a good question, because we're celebrating the 100th anniversary with things that the founders had never envisioned. They were years after founding it in 1913, just hoping for, as we'd said, a seedling mile of concrete. And, of course, today we zip over the almost all of it on concrete and celebrate those gas stations and memories that were decades later. So will that still be a fascination? I think the key is to that if younger people get involved, if the kids that have their licenses now and out of college in their 20s, will they be traveling the road? You know, they'll be doing it differently than those of us who are past our 20s, using their apps and there's recent reports that they're less interested in automobiles, which certainly has been a trend over the recent decades. But I think it will still fascinate people. I think that those bypasses have left the old sections of roads as sort of time warps back. They did us a favor by preserving those older cafes and gas stations that are being re-energized. And so it's not just a dying thing. It's becoming its own entity. It's not the Lincoln Highway that was. It's heritage tourism, for lack of a better word.
Brian, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Brian Butko is the author of many books about the Lincoln Highway. Hank Zalatel, thank you to you.
Thank you.
Hank Zalatel was a librarian for the Department of Transportation in Iowa for many years. And also thank you, Dan Otto.
You're welcome.
Dan Otto, an emeritus professor in the Iowa State University Department of Economics. Talk of Iowa was produced by Emily Woodbury, Dennis Reese, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins, with technical support today from Jason Burns. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, it's Horticulture Day. Talk of Iowa is a production of IPR News.